Accession number 18018, reel 2.
Major Pullen, reel 2.
Yes, I got him when he came out of detention, and I knew that he very much wanted to be a driver and join the MT. That's motor transport. So I had him on an interview and said I needed an orderly, and I knew he was a marksman on all weapons. I knew he was a good wireless operator, and would he like the job? And he said, no sir, he didn't want to be an orderly. I said, I have to have a Batman driver. He has to be taught how to drive. When do I start, sir? He said. He became an absolutely first-class driver. In fact, the motor transport officer tried to pinch him. So did the colonel. But having carved his niche, so to speak, he stuck with me there and subsequently through career, where he was absolutely vital. He was almost sergeant majors and sergeants and people like that would ask him if I wasn't available. For instance, what they thought I might do. And he was right almost every time. In fact, virtually every time.
What was Mr. English's Christian name?
Blowed if I know.
Doesn't matter.
When we were at Crowborough, I mentioned, though, the three girls, Davina Burney, Peggy Haycroft, and my wife, Scribble, who used to go and do their shopping around the area. When English was driving, he said, you drive your car into barracks in the morning, sir. You leave the car in there and then drive back in the evening. He said, why don't I take the car in and I can take the girls out shopping? And that's precisely what he used to do from time to time. I'd drive the car in. He'd take the car. It was an old Woolsey. Super looking old car. Quite a large one. And he'd pile the girls on board. They'd go into Tunbridge Wells or somewhere and do some shopping. He's proud as punch sitting up in front, driving the three of them. And would say, you know, what time do you ladies want pick it up? That sort of thing. He's really good. And, of course, girls liked it as well. It was absolutely thrilling, as opposed to buses and things like that. But anyway, I digress. That was... But that was English. But one thing my wife had said at one stage, when we, just before we left, having embarked at Southampton, just before, she said, keep an eye on my husband, William English, please. And so he said, yes, ma'am, I will. The first patrol that I went out, I detailed off four blokes. It was just a recce patrol. And it was dark. So I had number one jumping up and down to see if he rattled. Number two, number three, number four. There was number five. I said, who are you? It's English, sir. Come over here. Yes, sir. You're not detailed off for this patrol, English. Your good lady told me to look at you, sir. And I can't do that if I'm standing behind on a common. And he did. He was just like a shadow the whole time I was there. Super. What he wanted to do, if it had been possible, he was saying one day he'd probably get married, etc., etc. What he'd like to do is to stay throughout my career as an orderly with me, Then subsequently, when we retired, we'd retire at the same time. You know, and he and his wife could look after the house and things like that. Sort of housekeeper. That sort of character. Last I heard of him, he was in King's Lynn. Oh, this is years ago. But he was a bus driving instructor. In fact, I'd heard of him before that because he'd found out where my mother lived. This is when he was just driving double-decker buses. He'd stop the double-decker bus outside her bungalow and walk up to the bungalow and ask her if she wanted to have a lift into Great Yarmouth. With the passengers watching him going up the path to the bungalow. That was English.
So you were in Crowborough with Mr. English as your orderly when you were intelligence officer.
Yes.
And then, how then did you get to Korea?
Well, we were on the advance party, second in command IO, second in commands of companies. And after a fair, we went out in the Empire Orwell, and we left the battalion in Singapore and went by air to the Philippines, Japan, and Korea, where we were met by the Royal Ulster Rifles, who we were leaving. And we met them on arrival and went with them on the odd operation, prepared maps, found out the local territory, etc., etc., while we were there. Then when the battalion arrived, we had, of course, got the layout. And after a very, very short period of acclimatization, rather too short, really, were thrown in at the deep end and took over from the RUR. We'd done a certain amount of training on board the ship, but you can't train on board a ship. And when we got there, we'd been told that as the situation was fairly fluid, we forget about wiring. There's nothing much in the way of mines. And virtually the whole time we were there, we did nothing else apart from lay minefields and wire. It's an extraordinary country, Korea. Absolute extremes of climate. Like very, very hot. And dusty, very, very cold, down to minus 30, 40 degrees Celsius. And when it rained, it fairly hammered with rain, rather like a monsoon. Of course, all the dust turned to mud. It was pretty murderous trying to get around the place, actually, at times. And where the area that we were in, which was basically mountains, it was either straight up, well, not straight up, but very steep hills going up or going down, and narrow, sort of cultivated land in between, but very narrow. Korean houses, really intriguing, warmest host, basically made out of sort of clay, mud, reeds, wood, but there was a floor, and underneath the floor there was a trench, and near the doorway normally there's a pit dug which was filled up with charcoal, and the warmth went underneath the floor and up chimney at the far end of the hut. I was absolutely shattered when I went in to the first house as to how cozy it was. Wouldn't believe it. Our form of heating. We had American space heaters, which were lethal. They were sort of a round cylindrical type things with a carburetor. And my colour sergeant almost lost his life when one blew up in his tent. One blew up in the officer's mess in AA echelon, apart from various others. We preferred our own heaters. They were petrol fed, of course. For our own heater, we'd use an ammunition box, have a length of tubing about, a copper tubing about 18 inches long, with a rubber pipe and a tap. The rubber pipe went into a petrol can, which was outside bunker. There was a tap controlling petrol dripping through the pipe, through the copper tube. The copper tube went into the side of the ammunition box and dripped onto a tin with some sand in it. The sand was lit. The tube would heat up. And instead of drips of petrol, you had petrol vapour coming through, the form of gas, which you control with your tap. At the top, there was a exhaust pipe that went out, made out of tins smashed together, round tins. Which acted like a chimney going through the roof. I've had one of those glowing red in about, 5 or 6 minutes from lighting. And they were, although they were considered dangerous in a way, they weren't really, because the main bulk of petrol is outside the bunker. The only petrol you've got is coming down the tube itself. And that's only just dripping. And all you've got to do is just pull the tube out of the heater anyway and turn it off. And that's it. Out it goes. But it's very expensive on petrol, of course, considering the number of people that wanted them.
Who made these things? Who made them?
Oh, we did. You didn't need anything, you see. All you needed was a bayonet to make a hole in, put your tube in, ration tin, sand, and an ammunition box. That's it, you're in business. Oh, and that was the only different one. That was a screw to regulate the petrol supply or flow. But it's so simple to make. But as I said, you know, one could cook on them. Have a brew of tea. Put that sit on top. No problem. We also, of course, made our own showers, which generally, with hot water, which generally would be where there's a, well, the hills, there were streams flowing down the hills. And what you would do is take water off higher up the hill where the stream was coming down, cut it down on one side so you've got a natural gravitational flow, and that could go over the top of some oil and water mixed, which produces incredible heat, and so the pipe would go over the top of that and end up in the showers. So it's virtually lighter oil, and the other pipe would have cold water going down. Bang, bang, as simple as that. Nothing really, again, too difficult. Furniture, What we used was basically sandbags, which we'd fill up, make into the form of an armchair, for instance, and then fill other sandbags with straw as cushions and put them inside the sandbags. Put them on the chair. So they were really quite comfortable. Not very mobile, of course, but nevertheless. I'm just trying to think that mod cons, as far as bedding was concerned, we nearly always made a bed. We didn't like sleeping in sleeping bags, even though they were very, very effective. We had two sleeping bags. There was an outer and an inner. And frankly, inside those two, it could be minus 30, 40 degrees, and you're as warm as toast. Very, very effective. Quilted. And the clothing itself. The bed. Well, this was dead simple. All we did was get a frame raised off the floor and then just lace it with a signal wire. And there always seemed to be miles and miles and miles and miles of signal wire knocking around the place. So there was never really any shortage. And just laced it backwards and forwards and then put the steam bag on top of that. And that was really very comfortable because the wire would give just a bit. And as I said, most comfortable. I mean, any knit can be uncomfortable. And with just a small amount of effort, you can really make yourself very comfortable inside. In fact, inside a bunker was more comfortable than a tent, and certainly more secure. Normally you have your bunker with the slit trench running off it. There was one memorable day. We had identification panels, a red one and a yellow one, as I recall. And you would make them in various directions in the form of a T. You would put an L, you could put the leg down, the leg of whatever shape you were making up. These were for aircraft. As the aircraft flew over, one hill looks very much like another hill, which looks like another hill. We should have that day's correct panels out all the way along. The United Nations front. And so any aircraft that could come over would have the line marked out for them. Obviously, they were put on a reverse slope, so the Chinese couldn't see them, or Koreans. On one particular day, the Americans used to use quite a bit of napalm, which looks absolutely horrifying, but in practice, as we were at one stage on a bit of a receiving end of it, it wasn't nearly as terrifying as it looked. If you've got a sheeting of some sort over the top, it burns on the surface, it doesn't penetrate. And on this particular occasion, there's a couple of American aircraft came over and napalm just off my position. It was the only bit on the front that got it. And I didn't know it was happening until my platoon sergeant arrived head first into the bunker. He'd been outside and watched these aircraft coming down and saw the napalm leave the aircraft. And so he literally came in a hurry to join me in the bunker. Not satisfied with that, the blinders went round, and I got a line of 0.5 bullets smack up more or less the middle in my yellow panel, which, needless to say, I checked out straight away to make sure I'd got the correct day's pattern out, which I had. To put it mildly, I was a bit upset to the degree that I was on to the colonel, and all for getting in a jeep and going along sorting this blasted unit out that were hammering it on side. I was talked out of it. In fact, I just didn't get permission to go. But these things happen. Unfortunate though they might be. One interesting thing that happened was that we were forward on one particular occasion, and there's lots of wire around the place. Minefield, special routes through minefields, paths to walk, etc., etc. And a little Chinaman wandered through the minefield. Little Chinaman wandered through the minefield, through the wire, into a section position where the corporal, section commander, was cleaning his submachine gun, and the little Chinaman was trying to give him his rifle. So the corporal put his submachine gun together, put a magazine on it, turned around and said, "Put your hands up," which the little Chinaman did. He then marched him over to my command post, where little Chinaman said he was very mystified through our interpreter. We'd got a Korean interpreter who fortunately could speak Cantonese in the same dialect as a Chinaman, a schoolmaster. And little Chinaman said he was very worried because he had just found out he wasn't in China. He thought he was in China protecting against people who had invaded China. But he wasn't. Not only that, but he was a bit cheesed off with rations and food and everything else because his officers were eating so much better than he was. He was nearly always hungry. That prompted us to give him some chocolate. He was also already drinking tea, thoroughly enjoying himself, actually. And the thing that really got him puzzled was that his grandfather used to work for the English. And his grandfather said they were bloody fools, but they were all right. They were fair. So he wanted to know what he was doing, fighting against the English, who his grandfather said were all right. Now, sitting in a command post, it's not very easy to give an international lecture on the current situation as far as Korea was concerned. However, we gave him a rough idea. And I said, purely out of interest, "Where have you come from?" "Oh, I'll show you," he said. So outside the bunker we go. He said, "Over there." He said, "And over there, there's some more. And just behind that, there's some more people." He said, the other position, he said, "The machine gun's over there." And he's literally pointing out his entire front to us, albeit somewhat in the distance. I say somewhat in the distance because the two front lines were really quite a long way apart. They could be anything up to 1,500, 2,000 yards apart. However, he, having pointed this lot out, he said, "Well," he thanked us very much for the chocolate, asked us if we'd got any more he could take back with him, and said, if it was all right, he'd bring about 20 blokes or 25 across that following night. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but we can't let you go. And he said, why not? I came here by myself. Why can't I go back by myself? So then we had a bit more difficult explaining to do. Anyway, sent him back via Bataan headquarters, duly escorted. And did I cop the biggest mother and father rocket you've ever had? Not my position to interrogate people. I'm not in the intelligence corps. I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have asked him this. Golly, Burzard, I really got sticked off for the colonel. But I gather, when the little bloke got back, this is only hearsay, but he sort of sat down in a chair with three blokes going at him, and he didn't say a word. Terrified. But you see, he'd come from a hole into a hole. Same sort of people. If you're sitting in a room or a tent or somewhere other with people formally dressed, they're the others. I mean, we were dirty, he was dirty. Same people. More likely to loosen up and talk, which he did. Sorry, in a way, I couldn't have let him go. I wouldn't have minded Benny, he would have brought some more blows, of course.
Was he the only defector that you got?
Yeah, well, he didn't really defect. He was making a visit. yes.